fueled by facts and driven by truth. Broadcasting live from beautiful British Columbia, it's Roadkill Radio. And now, here are your hosts, Terry O'Neill and Mark Cashett.
And that's us, and I'm Terry, and introducing our new co-host, Mark Hashik. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Terry. Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. You were a guest on our show several weeks ago, and I think you must have made a good impression on all of us here at Roadkill Radio. So you are now an official rocker, RKR, Roadkill Radio rocker. So welcome to the team.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, that's good. Good to have you here tonight. We have a busy, busy night. And by the way, in case you'd forgotten who Mark Hashik was, we do share, we both come from a journalistic background, and Mark, you are also, we share one other listing of note.
That's right. I do believe that both you and I were among the Georgia Strait's top 10 most right-wing journalists in B.C.
Most influential right-wing
journalists.
I had no idea. That's right. It wasn't just that we were right-wing, but influential as well. Right. You know, you can be as right-wing as you want, but if you don't, it's not, you know, you got to get the rubber meeting the road on Roadkill Radio.
Amen.
That's good. So anyway, we have a big night tonight. Later in the show, we're going to be talking to Jay Niver. He's the communications director for the Alcohol Drug Education Service about the Insight legal challenge before the Supreme Court of Canada. You were at a conference recently where Jay was a participant, or did he lead that conference?
No, he didn't lead it, but it was a conference of mainly abstinence-based recovery homes and organizations, and they had a lot of interesting things to say. It was out in Surrey.
Yeah, okay. And I looked at the list of people on there, and I'm familiar with some of them. I know Linda... the Wesolowski people from the InnerVisions and some other people as well. So that should be good talk with Jay, and your insight will be good as well. We also are very pleased later in the show we'll be welcoming Linda Gibbons to the show. You might have seen she was on the front page of the National Post just yesterday after spending 10 of the last 17 years in jail and most of the last 18 months in jail for essentially a prisoner of going to jail for doing something that we here in Canada think we're allowed to do is have peaceful protests, right?
Unbelievable. A case that not many people know about. Maybe the least known case of a human rights violation in Canada in the last couple decades.
So she is a pro-life protester and protesting against abortion clinics and the practice of abortion in the province of Ontario. On their way to the province of Ontario is a band of walkers protesting abortion as well. And we're going to be checking in with them. They are the Life in Motion group, and Mike Hayden of the Crossroads Life in Motion Trekkers will be checking in with us from Alberta. We want to find out how their walk is going. They're a very religious, spiritual group, very, very deep in their faith, and I want to know if their faith is being tested a bit. They've had a tough time so far, so that should be an interesting discussion. And while talking about the life issues, we will in just a few minutes be talking to Alec Schadenberg. He's Executive Director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. Alex is back home in London, Ontario right now, but he was out here on Friday and Saturday to lead an international symposium.
Now, you went to that symposium.
I went to that for a day, and very interestingly, the morning I was there was the morning it was announced that Jack Kevorkian, Dr. Death, had died. And so it was a very timely symposium on euthanasia and doctor-assisted suicide, basic updates from around the world. Very interesting. And, you know, I was inspired, before we get to Alex, and Alex is holding right now, I was inspired after reading the coverage of Dr. Jack Kevorkian's death, and then also from what I heard and learned at the symposium to have a few thoughts, to put a few thoughts down on paper about specifically some of the words that were associated, some of the descriptions of Jack Kevorkian after he died. And I'll share those with you right now. Now, following the death of Jack Kevorkian last week, at least two news stories gave prominence to the fact that his lawyer issued a statement describing his client's passing as peaceful. lawyer Meyer Morgenroth was further quoted as saying his client didn't feel a thing, and added that no artificial attempts were made to keep Kevorkian alive. Now, Mr. Morgenroth's statement is significant in light of the what I think is a monomaniacal focus of Kevorkian's controversial life, to overturn laws that do not allow people to obtain assistance in killing themselves. Most often, his campaign was associated with terminally ill people who were seeking to avoid a painful or, in his words, undignified death. Now, one suspects that the lawyer disclosed the details surrounding the way Kevorkian died because, in part, the lawyer anticipated questions which would quite understandably be asked about this crucial event. Just as it's entirely natural for us to wonder whether the tough guy gangster holds true to his reputation when he's being strapped into an electric chair, or whether he turns into a blubbering baby, it's also important for us to know whether Kevorkian, the arch advocate for pain-free passing, had ended up enduring an uncomfortable or even painful death. One has a feeling that Mr. Morgenroth's statement was also designed to inform the public that Kevorkian had not been the victim of some sort of cosmic karma intent on teaching him a last-minute lesson about the untidy nature of death. Or perhaps the good lawyer wanted to assure Kevorkian's many supporters that the convicted killer had not become a traitor to the right to die cause and had willingly endured a painful death, and wouldn't that have been something? Left unsaid was whether Kevorkian had received painkilling drugs to ease his passage. Perhaps this information was intentionally omitted because it could have been seen as a testament to the growing ability of doctors to control the pain that so many terminal patients endure. Ironically, evidence of this expanding expertise is often used by opponents of assisted suicide to bolster their case that there is no need to legalize the right to die. Also notable is Morgenroth's declaration that no artificial means were used to extend Kevorkian's life. Now, one wonders what this little tidbit is supposed to signal. Now, given the arc of Kevorkian's career, one might conclude that he had issued a standing do not resuscitate order that reflected his desire to avoid any painful or depressing complications that might have followed some sort of heroic intervention. The final thoughts that come to my mind are related to the fundamental way in which the lawyer wanted us to view his client's death. Specifically, one wonders whether Mr. Morgenroth was attempting to shape our understanding of what constitutes a good death. Did he mean for us to conclude that by not dying in pain and by eschewing artificial means to extend his life, Kevorkian died a good death? Maybe so. But the public should not be misled into believing that a pain-free ending in which one gives oneself up willingly without a struggle is the only road to a good death. Many other ways to die can be at least equally good, of course. For example, we regularly talk about how cancer victims fight their disease with courage, using every means possible to beat back the deadly scourge. Are their subsequent deaths not good deaths too? I would think they are. We'll give the great poet Dylan Thomas the last word here. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rage at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And that's what I think. Alex Schadenberg, what do you think about it?
What do I think of Jack Kevorkian?
Yes.
Well, I did respond.
Welcome, by the way, Jack. Sorry, Alex.
Yeah, my name's not Jack.
I know, sorry.
So she says, my point has been that, the first response I gave, because I got a call the early of the morning of the first day of the symposium, I was on my computer trying to pull a few things together, and boom, my phone was ringing and asking me for comments. My first response was just to offer condolences. I'm thinking, it's not right to speak ill of the dead. I just don't think there's certain things you do. And then the next thing I thought is, yes, but I do want people to remember Jack for who he actually was. Because, as you know, over the last few years, the euthanasia lobby has been doing its best to try and, rewrite history, to replace Jack in history so people can think of him as something that he wasn't. And this started around 2005. There was a book written about Jack, and there has been a couple plays about Jack, and now a movie about Jack, and all of these literary attempts are trying to, you know, tell us that he was something different than he actually was. So that's the one thing I was sort of concerned about. Will people remember him for what he was, or will they somehow buy into this new persona that the euthanasia lobby is trying to sell on us?
Yes, and it was interesting, I thought, as well, all the obituaries written about Jack Kevorkian all did a pretty good job describing his specific career, his eccentricities, his oddities, his unnatural fixation on death. But they did a very poor job, I thought, of looking at the issue more broadly, the issue of doctor-assisted suicide and euthanasia and all the various things that are happening around the world. And that's where I thought that the symposium you held in Vancouver last Friday and Saturday was so effective and stood in such, you know, strong counterpoint, really, to what we were seeing, the coverage about Kevorkian. Well, that's fine. You either hate him or you love him. But what's really going on and what's going to be taking place? I know that my co-host for the night, Mark Hashuk, is interested as well in finding out sort of where we stand around the world in the ongoing legal and political and moral battles between the various groups. Are you able to sum up what you heard from the symposium?
Well, basically, we've been winning. Basically, the situation is that the euthanasia lobby continues to push, and people who are opposed to euthanasia and assisted suicide continue to convince politicians without a question that you can't do this safely, and if you can't do this safely, you're best not to do this at all, because the fact is these safeguards don't work. Every time there's, I'll give you an example. I had this interview with another major radio show. I don't know if it's as big as your radio show. on Saturday, and they put me up against this Margaret Batten, who's written a study. She's from the University of Utah, and her study basically can conclude that there is no worry with euthanasia and assisted suicide. Go ahead and legalize. Don't have any fears. The fact is that she's a long-time euthanasia campaigner. She happens to hold the university position, so now she can call herself a researcher. And so the funny thing is that the interviewer then said to Alex, have you read this study, in order to try and prove that I'm some sort of wacko? And in fact, I had not only read that study, I had analyzed it thoroughly and written extensively on her study, because it was a false study. It was a study that went nowhere, and its conclusion did not connect to the facts of the study. So in fact, it was a way of spinning the facts in order to tell you something different. So she says there is no slippery slope, there's no worry, there's no fear. If you're people with disabilities, you shouldn't worry about this either. It's all fine, go ahead, legalize, let death come, it's okay, it'll all be fine. And in fact, it was all a lie. So anyway, I challenged her, I put her in her place, and then I get a call the next day saying, oh, well, that same interviewer had her on the next day without me, to give her a chance to rebut what I had said about her study.
Oh, wait a minute.
That wasn't on the second day.
I want you to name names here. Who did this? So he had you and her on at the same time.
Yeah, well, actually,
and because you whomped her, he brought her on again the next day just to have.
Yeah, well, but basically, you know, I've written heavily on this Margaret Batten study. So it was the Roy Green Show, and they had me on the Saturday. And I explained that her study is a false study, because in fact what she did is she took all the concerns that people like I and others have shown from the studies from the Netherlands, etc. She does look at all those concerns. She mentions them in her study. So by acknowledging these concerns, you can't say that she's just hidden the facts. But in fact, her conclusions do not connect to the information in her study. So in fact, I'll give you an example. The 550 deaths that were without explicit request or consent, found in the last major Netherlands study. So that was published in 2007.
So that's significant. Yeah, that's significant. I mean,
550 deaths without request or consent. Now, that was down from the previous study from 2000, which was 9.
So these are medical personnel or family members making the decision on behalf of a person who's not able to make a decision, or maybe is able but isn't asked.
It's a combination situation. Sometimes it's a situation where the doctor admits to just doing it on their own. You see, what happens is every 5 years the Dutch do what they call an in-depth study, and they send questionnaires to every physician in the country, and they give them total anonymity. So the doctors know that they can answer freely without worrying about going to jail or getting prosecuted or anything, And then they specifically asked him, well, how many deaths per year, how many euthanasia deaths were you involved in this year? Deaths without request or consent. Those are ones where no one asked for it, but you did it anyway. And, of course, those numbers have been published. So you might remember the Remmerlink report from 1990 showed 1,040. The similar study in 2000 showed 950, and the study in 2005 showed 550. So it's still significant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, she looks at those numbers, and she says, yes, but they have a different medical system in the Netherlands, and doctors tend to know their patients far better because they home visits and all this kind of thing, and da-da-da-da. Therefore, they would have known the values of the person. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. Well, how does she know that?
Yeah,
did she interview all 550 families and find out, oh, yes, we were longtime friends with Dr. So-and-so, and he knew our values well, and this is exactly what so-and-so, you know, Hank would have wanted this. She doesn't know that. She doesn't know that at all, but she writes that, so she can just sort of write it off and say, there, I dealt with it. I acknowledged it, and I dealt with it. It's a false study.
Yeah.
It's an excellent way to denounce your enemy by acknowledging their concerns and writing them off. So anyway, that's what her
yeah,
study
Mark,
did.
Mark has a question here.
Hi, Alex. Mark Hashik here. I want to bring it back across the pond, back to Canada.
Yes.
What do you want from the federal government, possibly in the form of legislation? I'm sure you guys have conversations about that.
Well, we have perfect laws in Canada as they are, so I want the laws to be upheld, and I want our police services, et cetera, to do what is right. And to make sure that when somebody's actually been euthanized or their life has been taken through assisted suicide, that the law is upheld. That's what I want. I am concerned about the level of care we still provide in Canada. We're not doing that great a job of end-of-life care.
Right.
We have a lot of problems within our systems that need to be dealt with, but our laws are perfect. I'm concerned right now about Quebec. Quebec is trying to give us euthanasia by the back door. So the Quebec government is looking at the question of euthanasia and assisted suicide right now, and they're looking at turning a blind eye to the law by either A, prosecution guidelines, or B, definitions of health care. That's a big concern, because if Quebec does that, then in fact other provinces might just do the same.
Now, go ahead.
Listen, I'm with you. I believe in the sanctity of life from conception to its natural end, and I'm a libertarian. You're talking about enforcing the laws that are on the books. You know more about those laws than I do, but I think we all know people in who are close to us, whether it was friends or family, who let people essentially die. They weren't pulling the plug. I'm just interested.
Yeah, but there's nothing morally wrong with that. We're all going to die. We don't have a problem with natural death, and I don't have a problem with providing proper care. I don't have any problems with pain control. Even at certain times, you have to pull the plug, you have to pull a ventilator at times because someone's dying. You accept the limits of life. But that's totally different from actually causing someone's death. You see, this issue is not about someone's freedom or will, or it's not about suicide. What it is about giving doctors or somebody else the right to cause your death. I don't want someone to have the right to cause my death. I just don't feel comfortable in any way, shape, or form saying so-and-so has the right to kill me. I don't think that's a good thing in any way, shape, or form.
Alex, you talked about wanting the laws in Canada enforced.
Have we
not seen recently that even when they are enforced, that there's judicial slaps on the wrist, very light sentences, and in some cases for mercy killings and things like that? Not talking about Latimer. The Latimer, they threw the book at him, essentially.
Well, they actually gave him a bit of an off, too, because he was convicted of second-degree murder when they proved to the trial that he had planned it.
Yeah, I've written about second-degree murder and first-degree murders in the past, and it takes quite a lot for somebody to be charged and convicted of first-degree murder in Canada, and that's just a general problem. But yeah, he was convicted of second-degree murder. But there's been several other cases of late, have there not, where there's been very light sentences or things just kind of disappeared, right?
So there is a reality that in the Assisted Suicide Act, it's quite clear that there's no minimum sentence, that you could be charged and convicted and receive up to 14 years. But in fact, Morris General, who was convicted in 1999, he got 2 years less a day. I think that's probably the most significant sentence mm-hmm. anyone has received for assisted suicide. Nonetheless, there is no minimum sentence. So it is very difficult knowing that all these cases are very emotionally charged. Nonetheless, I don't think that at the same time we should be letting them off scot-free.
So let me stop you there then. You said the laws in Canada were perfect. Well, the sentencing provisions are in the law, are part of the Criminal Code of Canada, and in various laws as well. Would you like to see the federal government move to put a minimum sentence in 2 years, 5 years,
really
or something?
I don't really know, okay. because I'd have to compare it to other types of sentences for similar type acts. So it would be similar to manslaughter, and as you know, there's no minimum sentence for manslaughter. So if there were a minimum sentence for manslaughter, then possibly there could be a minimum sentence for assisted suicide, because both are dealt with in a very similar manner by sentencing and by the law. Nonetheless, there's been very few cases of assisted suicide. As much as people like to talk about the thousands and thousands of cases that are happening all the time, it's simply not true. And when studies have been done, I'll tell you, give you an example. There was a serious study done in the UK just a few years ago, and they really did try and find cases of assisted suicide in the UK, and they found almost none. So, you know, when we start looking at these situations, and they talk about the fact that it is illegal is a huge deterrent. Are there unethical things going on in our hospitals? Absolutely. But is assisted suicide and euthanasia regularly happening? The answer is it's actually unlikely.
Yeah, well, on that point, I'd like to talk about an issue that came up during the part of the symposium that I attended, and that was the issue of terminal sedation, and which is sort of this area where if there are a lot of assisted suicides or euthanasia practices going on, it may be happening under this umbrella of, well, you know, this person is in pain, this person is dying, we're going to give them painkillers, and you know what, we're just going to give that extra little dose to make sure they die more quickly. Is that an issue? Is that a problem?
Well, it is possible that sedation is being abused. Certainly in Quebec, the Quebec College of Physicians have said that we need to legalize euthanasia because we are doing it already through terminal sedation. Now, sedation is not euthanasia. To sedate somebody who might be in serious pain, first of all, that does not cause your death to sedate them. But secondly, the proper use of sedation is not about causing someone's death. It's about relieving them of their pain, allowing them to die naturally without being in pain. So that's all gay. There's nothing wrong with
okay,
that, right?
Okay, so what is the term?
The problem is the abuse of sedation.
Okay, what does the term terminal sedation imply? Does that imply like a deliberate attempt to terminate somebody, or is this just, we're going to give this dose for this person that will last this long?
To it as terminal sedation because they sedate the person until they've actually died. But that doesn't mean they've actually killed them.
Oh, okay.
What it means is they sedated them. Now,
I thought there was something ominous about that.
The better term for the ethical approach is palliative sedation, where you palliate their pain by sedating them. The fact is that the whole process can be abused, and yes, we can be doing euthanasia, you know, undercover through these things, but the fact is the proper use should not be discouraged. If someone's in intractable pain, we are far better to be sedating them than to be allowing them to be in pain and suffering, and we're far better to sedate people than to be killing people.
Alex, I want to go back to Kevorkian for a second. He was canonized by Hollywood last year in a movie starring Al Pacino.
Yeah.
I wanted to get your perspective. What impact did Kevorkian have on the euthanasia issue and how it's perceived or portrayed in popular culture?
Well, you know, Kevorkian actually is like other sort of people who were more extreme than others on an issue. He gave the more mainstream euthanasia people more of an area for them to have in the political spectrum. So since he was seen as more extreme than others who were also advocating very, very similar acts, maybe even the same acts, they were seen as being, you know, normal. But when we look further at Jack Kevorkian, what happened is that he wasn't really about assisted suicide for terminally ill people. Because if you consider even his very first person who he helped to take her life, or he was involved with taking her life, Janet Atkins, you know, he didn't even meet her at first. It was her husband that called Jack, saying, my wife has been, told she's got Alzheimer's, and I think we're going to come to visit you, Jack. And in fact, Janet Atkins had just played tennis just a couple weeks before she died, so she was far from being terminally ill. The fact is that Jack figured, here's someone willing, I'm going to do it now and get people to get to know me. I'm going to become the hero very quick. The very second case that he did, very second one, so this is very early on in his spree of taking life, the very second case, the woman not only wasn't terminally ill, she wasn't even sick. It was Marjorie Wants, who was 58, and she was complaining that she had had long-term untreatable vaginal pain. And her doctors had never found out what was wrong with her, and when they did an autopsy, they found nothing wrong with her. And that was the second death. And then when you go through the numbers, Detroit Free Press did a major, major expose on this whole situation way back, about 15 years ago, a little less than that now, actually. It was, I believe, in 97, and it showed that 60% of the deaths were people with disabilities, that five of the deaths, the people weren't even sick, and it was all from their autopsies. It showed that 17 of the people who had died were clearly not only not dying, would have likely lived a very long time. So these people who had disabilities, but there was no terminal condition here. So the fact is that Jack wasn't very concerned about the people whose lives were lost. He was more concerned about promoting an agenda. And I think we have to really understand what Jack was about. Now, certainly, his promotion of the agenda did help the euthanasia lobby. It helped them a lot because nobody talked about this issue very much before Jack made it very popular.
He also became a bit of a martyr by going to jail.
He did become a martyr by going to jail. And in fact, what was very interesting, when he was first convicted, he had told the judge and everything, you know, if you send me to jail, I'm just going to stop eating and drinking, and I'm going to die in jail within a couple of weeks. He did that for a few days, and then he decided that was a bad idea. So it's funny
steak.
How Jack was, you know.
Yeah.
It's very interesting indeed. And, of course, when they released him from jail in 2007, he got an early release because supposedly he was dying. I guess the predictions of his death were overrated because he lived about, 3.5 more years.
That's right. You talk about the powerful the public persona of Jack Kevorkian, how he moved the debate. But something that I heard at the symposium from at least one of the presenters was some of the tools that can be used by people who oppose doctor-assisted suicide and euthanasia to counteract the propaganda that comes out and to the sort of the messaging that can be used. And one of them that really struck home was the that seemed to me would be very powerful was to use the to reframe the debate to say, well, what we're really talking about here is elder abuse.
Right.
It was told that that was one of many strategies. Can you talk about that and some of the other
strategies? Okay, well, the first thing I should actually say, and then I'm going to go into elder abuse, is that I didn't finish what I was talking about Canada, because what's happened is we were so successful at defeating the euthanasia legislation here in Canada. It was defeated last year by 228-59. There's now a conservative majority government, which means there's no political will to legalize euthanasia or assisted suicide in Canada at this time. So what the euthanasia lobby has done is now they've gone into the court. So there's two court cases right now in BC to try and overturn our laws in Canada. So they couldn't win through democratic means, so now they're going to hope that they bump into a liberal judge who will accept their arguments in the courts.
Oh, a liberal judge in British Columbia? Oh, gee.
I know. Good luck, eh?
Yeah, right. Good luck. Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's why they chose British Columbia rather than Alberta.
That's right.
Anyway, the fact is that's where they're going now is into the courts. Now, the issue of elder abuse is actually a real issue because the fact is we know that elder abuse has become a significantly, I call it the scourge of elder abuse, that in fact people who are elderly are finding themselves experiencing a lot greater abuse than is ever actually being discussed in society. And society has a serious problem. How are we going to stop the problem of elder abuse? Now, elder abuse is often seen as financial or, you know, things like that. But in fact, if you go and check the Google alerts, you'll see it's very, sadly, it's common that elder abuse can also be homicide.
Right.
So when we look at the issue of euthanasia and assisted suicide, you have to put this in perspective. Elder abuse is underreported. Why is it underreported? It is underreported because it's usually done by family or friends. So these are people that the person is dependent on.
Right.
So because they're dependent on these people already, they don't report
right.
the abuse.
And so by framing a discussion about euthanasia under the rubric of elder abuse, you're doing sort of like what Ezra Levant did when he talked about ethical oil. You're drawing on the liberals, the environmentalists, you're saying, and everybody who, you know, like on one hand, a kind of a middle of the road left leaning liberal might, you know, be sympathetic towards. Let me just finish here. Might be sympathetic towards. Doctor-assisted suicide, but at the same time, very much in favor of stamping out elder abuse. So you've sort of got that person hooked when you talk about elder abuse and could possibly change the mind.
Well, the fact is that the person who has really been involved in the elder abuse question is Margaret Doerr. She's an elder law attorney from Washington State, and she was speaking at the symposium. And Margaret Doerr has made it her professional career to be involved with many elder abuse cases as a lawyer. And she was also the past, for the American Bar Association, she was their past chair of their elder abuse committee. So this is a real important issue for her. And the reason she became opposed to assisted suicide, she's a Democrat, she's a liberal, she's a pro-choice person who has been involved in the elder abuse question. She viewed the issue of assisted suicide that was being debated in Washington State as you can't do this, because when you read the legislation, it is what she called creating new avenues for elder abuse.
There you go.
And when you look at it and you read it through, you have to agree with her.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as she said, there's first of all, there's not even a witness at the time of death. And she said, wait a second here. The other thing is, the other side's always saying, oh, wait a second, assisted suicide is being done in the state of Oregon to mainly wealthy, educated people. And, you know, she was always saying, don't you guys see it? Wealthy, educated people are also the ones who are the prime people or who are suffering elder abuse. Why? Because their good son and their good daughter have something to take from them. It's called money, influence. Maybe they didn't like mom or dad, and this is their way of taking it out on them in their later years. The fact of it is elder abuse stats are not lesser amongst the wealthy population. They're actually higher amongst the wealthy population.
Yeah,
so, you know, the fact is you can't say this isn't about abuse. You can't prove it's not about abuse, and that's the whole point.
Yeah.
You just can't.
I want to pause just here for a second to remind listeners and viewers that they are listening to Roadkill Radio, and please feel free to send us an email at roadkillradio@live.ca. We'd like to hear from you if you have any questions, comments, or even criticisms, queries for our guest, Alex Schadenberg, Executive Director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. Dealing with the media was also a theme that came up now and again in the symposium, and the difficulties and the biases that we're talking about the downstream media here, Alex, not the good old
Roadkill Radio.
Not Roadkill Radio media. What you already described. Problem you had with Roy Green and the Roy Green Show, and that's shocking, really. Do you see any general trend of getting better or worse in sort of this accepted wisdom of the downstream media regarding this issue?
Well, what I do see is the media in general is not as monolithic as it once was. There's far more media from different sides of issues than I would have seen 10 years ago than today. But the fact is those who really support euthanasia and assisted suicide, I think are becoming rather frustrated by the situation because they probably were under the belief 10 years ago that this was going to become legal at any moment, and it simply has not become legal. So I think they're becoming a bit more strident.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I view it.
Alex, I think that's a great point. I think that the rise of the internet, the information highway, has really halted a lot of so-called progressive juggernauts that maybe sometime in the 90s were gathering strength towards the finish line. But because of the internet and different media outlets, the exchange of information, you know, not just in North America, all across the world, I think that that has gone a long way in educating people about issues like any life issue. Would you agree with that?
I'll give you an example. Like in the past, if we were shut out from the mainstream media as a whole, there just would not have been an opportunity to speak to the general public at all. But as it is today, we can be shadowed from most of the mainstream media and yet still have a voice in society because of the new avenues that exist. But because of that also, I find that there's more voices in the system. I do recognize that there are many perspectives that are now well visible within today's media that were not, it was more monolithic not so long ago. So anyway, as I say that, but I do think it's become more extreme from the other side. The other thing is that they don't seem to look at the issue and say, is there really a good reason for being opposed to this? You know, for instance, Dr. Margaret Cottle, who was speaking at the symposium, she's from the Vancouver area, a palliative care physician. She made the comment, well, you know, medicine has opposed euthanasia and assisted suicide for 2,400 years since the time of Hippocrates. So this is not just a Christian thing. Hippocrates was not a Christian. He existed before Christ. And she said, we have a heritage of 2,400 years. Before you throw out your heritage, don't you think you should examine why the heritage began in the first place? And I think that's a very good point. Why has society opposed the killing of its most vulnerable? That's a very good question. And when you start coming up with the answers, you should be feeling very uncomfortable with the concept of legalizing this.
Well, what's the, I mean, deep down, what's the agenda that's driving this? Is there some force that's behind this and maybe has other manifestations in our society as well?
Well, you have to break it down into the average person who supports this. And we can see that in the polling numbers, and then the leadership of the euthanasia lobby, which has a very different perspective than the average person who supports this. The average person is not strongly in support of euthanasia or assisted suicide. So when we see the polling, it shows that approximately 70% of Canadians support the concept of legalization. But our polling has always asked the other questions. You know, are you concerned about people with disabilities? Are you concerned about the care that we're providing our elderly in nursing home care? Are you concerned about the level of end-of-life care, pain control care, et cetera, palliative care that we have in Canada? And then when you look at it, we always ask in our polls, do you think the Canadian government should legalize euthanasia or assisted suicide, or should it improve end-of-life care? And the huge majority strongly support the improvement of end-of-life care over euthanasia.
It depends on how you ask the question.
What you're seeing is Canadians are reacting to a fear. It's absolutely natural the way they are reacting. They're saying, I don't want to die suffering. I can understand that. Okay? Or they might say, I wouldn't want to live in the nursing home care that my aunt so-and-so lived in. I would rather be dead than live like she lived. Well, I don't know how she lived myself, because there's some excellent nursing home care and there's some very secondary or poor nursing home care. And we understand that. But we can understand it's a natural fear to react that way. So are they saying they want legalization? No. What they're saying is, I don't want to go through those bad conditions. So what is the answer? To legalize killing?
Not in my books.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. Now, the leadership of the euthanasia movement, they come from a very philosophical point of view.
Uh-huh.
And you see that with Dr. Nitsky in Australia, Kevorkian himself, the Final Exit Network people, etc. They have this radical autonomy point of view. It's a radical autonomy. They want total control over all things, even the things that are not what you actually control. Because remember, when we're talking about euthanasia, we're talking about somebody else is actually causing your death.
I just want to step in here now, because that's what's so infuriating about this right to die concept. Hey, you've got the right to die. Everybody's, you know, you've got, you have to, we don't need to pass a law to give you the right to die. You can kill yourself. I'd hate it if it happens, but right. You've got that right. Anytime, we're not going to stop you from doing that. Well, I'm actually going to stop you. We actually do try. If somebody's standing on the side of a ledge,
if someone's totally depressed, we should try and stop.
We should exactly. But you do have that right. It's not enshrined anywhere. But they're not asking for the right to die.
They're asking for
the right
me or somebody else to cause their death.
Absolutely, which is an entirely different thing and raises a million problems. And that's
they're wanting the
big
nation
point.
To be directly involved in this. Now, what was very interesting is. The New Hampshire last year defeated a bill, substantially defeated a bill to legalize assisted suicide. And this was a bill that was defined in the same way as the Oregon and Washington state bills. So they're quite restricted to assisted suicide, and they have restrictive type language, so it's not going to just be for anybody, right? Nonetheless, the government committee, the judicial committee, voted 15-1 against the bill. What did the head of the judicial committee say? He said, it is not the place of the government to be involved in causing the death of their citizens. That was right on. Now, I'm just sort of seeing the transcripts now. It's coming out now where you can see all these transcripts, and we're looking through it. And I thought, what a strong – that's what they're voting on.
Very strong
the
statement.
The chair saying, we are the government. We are the government, and we do not have the right to be involved with causing the death of our citizens.
Alex,
very smart.
Alex, on that note, we're going to have to say goodbye. We've got a jam-packed show tonight. Alex Schadenberg, Executive Director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. Alex, what's your website?
It's epcc.ca, Euthanasia Prevention Coalition Canada.ca, epcc.ca.
Thank you for joining us tonight and staying up so late. From London, Ontario, and the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, Alex Schadenberg. Good night.
Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. It's always a very well-informed, well-spoken guest.
Absolutely, yeah.
He really knows his stuff. He is the guy to go to for issues on that. And I don't doubt. I mean, it's sad to hear that a guy like Roy Green, who has that great podium, has him on with the other side for a debate on one day, and because Alex wins it so handily.
Right.
I hope that's not. Maybe this could be a troublesome. I hope that that's the way that I'm not making things up, and he didn't make things up. But it's to have the opponent on the next day to give the that person a fair shot at it is unbelievable.
Right.
Listen, before we go to the next guest, and that will be Mike Hayden of the Crossroads Life in Motion Trek. I do want to update our listeners and viewers about an issue that we raised last week. You might remember it was the troubling case of a couple from Salmon Arm, British Columbia, who had had their first child, was seized by the ministry, placed in foster care, and this couple was expecting their second child, and they laid out their whole problem to us. Well, since then, there's good news in that the baby has, little baby Sabina has been delivered. Magna gave birth by C-section on June 5th down here at the Royal Columbian Hospital in New Westminster. And as expected, the ministry apprehended the baby immediately. The father, Kevin, who was in our studio as well as Sabina last week, was actually prohibited from being in the delivery room. Police were even on the scene. We're going to be following this as it goes along. I know Carrie is very interested and very involved in this. But the news right now is that little baby Sabina has been born, is healthy, and Magna and Kevin, of course, are now parents of two children, neither of them in their custody anymore, and they never really have been. So we'll be following more of that later. Speaking of the issue of births, and that was a happy occasion, a live birth. From my point of view, all too many births end in the destruction of the unborn child here in Canada and across the Western world. We're talking about abortion. And the issue, of course, was it's the issue you can never raise except during an election when anybody does raise it, is all of a sudden told they can't raise it again. So it's one of these strange things. It was on the front page of the National Post yesterday with Linda Gibbons. We'll be talking to her in a couple of minutes. But first, joining us from Alberta is Mike Hayden from the Crossroads Life in Motion Walk Across Canada with a group of young men and women to raise awareness about the sanctity of life and oppose abortion. Hello, Mike, are you with us?
Yeah, yeah, I'm here.
Hi, thank you very much. I've been reading some of your updates. It sounds like, now, you're a very religious group of young men and women, a lot of praying, but it seems to me that you think that maybe the forces of evil are aligned against you. You've had a lot of things going wrong.
Well, we have, actually, yeah. I mean, we've had, it's the usual stuff you expect. I mean, you have 11 young people walking across the country with a few support vehicles. You're going to expect, you know, not everything's going to go right all the time. So we did have a car wreck along the way. Well, a man actually swiped his car into ours as we were driving along. Yeah, just like little things, you know, running into bears and a lot of injuries. Each of the walkers is, you know, foot injuries and stuff as we go along. But the last week, it's actually, we've seen a lot of good stuff as well, you know, like a lot of the problems with the RV, our support vehicle, started fixing. And it's been going really well, actually, since we left British Columbia, actually.
Okay, nice. So tell us what exactly was the goal of this walk, and are you beginning to accomplish what you've set out to accomplish? You're walking from British Columbia to Ottawa, right?
Yeah, well, we walk actually from Vancouver to Baie St. Paul, Quebec, and then we circle back and end in Ottawa with a rally on Parliament Hill on August 13th with some members of Parliament and the Archbishop, actually, there. The purpose of this walk, of course, is, as you said, we are a very religious group. We pray for the end of abortion in our country, and for all other life issues such as euthanasia, you know, teenage suicide, and other causes like that. But as we walk, we give a witness. We wear these big shirts, white shirts that just say pro-life on them. And the purpose of our mission is to give us a peaceful, a silent witness to the dignity and sanctity of life. And we reach out to all those we meet with the message that all human life is sacred. So if anyone stops along the side of the road, talks to us, and on the weekends we stand outside of the abortion facilities, and if anyone wishes to come over, any young women who are going in there, we give them counseling, direct them to the right areas. And we also give support to a lot of the pro-life groups as we go along the way. We raise money for pro-life causes. Yeah, we're accomplishing all of that, just immense success as we've been going along.
Mike, give us a sense of how, Mark Hashik, by the way, give us a sense of how you're being treated on the road. Abortion, very controversial issue.
It is.
Maybe give us a couple of examples of the good and the bad as far as interaction with the public.
Well, on Monday we did our walk through downtown Calgary, and we walked with about 12 of us through the downtown core of the city. And a good reaction is, you know, a man standing in front of his restaurant sees us walk by. And they all start cheering, and he invites us in, gives us bubble tea and slushies for the whole team. and then we go along. I mean, we have tons. There's horns going all the time as we go. You know, you just see endless cars go by. And then some of the cars will swerve at us, you know, as we're walking along the side of the road. You know, we see a lot of people are very hurt by this issue. A lot of people have been either, you know, hurt by abortion or, you know, has affected their life in some deep way. And they're not necessarily mad at us as people, who we are. But they're mad at, you know, the image brings up a lot of anger inside of them. And so we do get a lot of very violent, angry reactions. Although nothing that we do is, you know, outwardly violent in any way. We're peacefully walking along the side of the road. But
Mike, are you a student?
I am. Yeah, I am. I'm a third-year university student,
mm-hmm.
Entering my fourth year now, studying for my BA.
Where?
And all of the walkers actually are all university students.
Okay. I went out to the University of British Columbia a couple of years ago to cover for a newspaper I was working for, the Club Days. I'm sure you're familiar with these. Take place in September. All the individual clubs set up booths around campus try to recruit members. And I went out there, and it was boring. It was really boring. You know, it was the same old thing. I saw the environmental club, you know, the chess club. But things picked up when I happened upon the pro-life club at UBC. And what I saw there were young people, not many of them, I think there was a handful, maybe five or six, who were living outside of the culture. They were doing something daring on a campus that would be hostile to their message. How do you find, as a pro-life student, your school life? Do you talk about the issue? Are you part of a club at school? How's that work?
I'm very much involved in the issue everywhere I go. I go to a small school outside of Ottawa, actually Ontario. Now, the school I go to is a Catholic university, so there it's quite easy to be outspokenly pro-life and not receive any sort of criticism for it. However, we do travel.
Not in all Catholic universities, by the
way.
Not
in all
states, I know there are some big problems.
That is very true, actually. Why don't I say this one Catholic university called Our Lady Seat of Wisdom Academy, which is a very staunch Catholic, a Catholic school in line with the Magisterium of the Church. However, yeah, we do go support other pro-life groups at some Catholic universities that are under heavy fire. The University of Calgary, their group is in a lawsuit right now. We support them heavily. University of Guelph, they're under a lawsuit attack as well. So everywhere we go, I mean, it's being a student, being pro-life, being a young person, being pro-life is very intense.
I always find it so inspiring, you know. A lot of students on campus like to present themselves as radicals, like they're doing something daring, but oftentimes what they're doing is very safe because it's the fashionable issues that seem to catch a lot of the attention.
Yeah.
I find, especially when people are coming from a Christian perspective in the pro-life movement, I just find it very inspiring to see people following in the radical tradition of Christ and speaking up for what they believe in.
Yeah, well, it's our honor to be able to do this, and I hope it continues every year in Canada. This is my second walk across the country. I did it last year, and I'm leading this year's walk, and I hope to continue to push this movement in Canada and get more and more young people involved. I mean, in the States, there's four groups walking across the States. I mean, about 50 students down there. And we have our 11 students up here, but it's growing, you know, and it's, once again, it's coming into the news, you know, with the Stephen Harper and the government, and everywhere we go, we see it. I mean, Canada is, in my experience, from walking across the country and seeing every aspect of society from Vancouver to the middle of Saskatchewan to Toronto, you know, to the heart of Quebec, Canada is pro-life. The areas that we hear, you know, the downtown Toronto, the big areas where there's mostly liberal news outlets is, they have the main voice, but... people, I believe that Canada is mostly pro-life. It's just no one is willing to speak up about it.
Mike, obviously you're a very committed person, and the dozen or so young people that are walking with you are very committed as well. But at the same time, a walk like this and the exposure that you're getting has to affect you somehow. How is it changing you, or is it changing you?
Oh, my goodness, yeah, so much. I mean, at the beginning of the walk last year, a walker told us, you will be a different person at the end of this walk. And I told that to my walkers this year as well. It just opens your eyes so much to society at large. I mean, it is a walk of mercy. We're not here to condemn. And it really teaches us so much humility and just being able to look at all people and accept them, who they are, where they're at, and love them for it. And then as ourselves, I mean, we walk 12 hours a day sometimes, you know, and you're putting your body, your mind, and your soul through intense, rigorous exercise, you know, constantly speaking to people, and just staying on top of all the issues that you need to know, educating yourself about the pro-life issue and all the faith issues that we also deal with along the way. And so just being able to live in a community too, it's changed me so much, and I've just become a much more stable, quieter, and a happier person because of it.
Oh, that's not good to hear. One final question, because we have to move on. We've got a jam-packed show tonight. I don't know if you heard, but our next guest is going to be Linda Gibbons.
We met Teller Mary Wagner, another good pro-life lady who was in prison. We met with her along the way, so if you can give a shout-out to Linda for us, that would be great.
Good. So one final question here, one final note is, how can people learn about what you're doing? Speaking of learning, have you been getting much coverage in the traditional daily media, newspapers, television, or radio, or they're basically ignoring you?
Basically, no one likes to talk about it. It's basically ignored. We had one newspaper interview with the Soyuz Times, a small little newspaper in a Soyuz, British Columbia.
Yeah.
But other than that, no. The news is generally tries to avoid us.
Yeah. So how can people find out on their own? Do you have a blog, a website, or a Facebook page?
We have a website. It's crossroadwalks.org. And that's an American website, and you can find your way to the Canadian Walk on their website there. That's our headquarters.
Okay.
And if anybody's interested in going to our blog, it's crossroadscanada.blogspot.com.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
And we have weekly updates and pictures and everything on there. So.
Excellent. Well, I was just looking at it today, and it seems that your group is very smitten with the scenery here in British Columbia.
beautiful, beautiful. The hike to the mountains is just gorgeous.
That's
quite
right.
Intense.
Okay, well, Godspeed, Mike Caden, and to
well,
the rest of your group.
Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you very much for joining
right, God
us.
Bless.
Good luck, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
That's right. I think there's one time I can wish them Godspeed. They're a religious group, and it's kind of a journey they're on, a spiritual, political, social quest, quite something. There was some coverage about their departure in the from British Columbia in the BC Catholic newspaper last week. Really good pictures, and there's nice pictures on this website, on the blog that they have there. A good group of young people, and you know, the commitment that they're showing is unbelievable.
Yeah.
A third-year student. Were you that well-spoken when you were in third-year university?
No, I was speaking into beers at that point in time.
That's right. Well, I'm very impressed with Mike there. Very, very good speaker and a good contact to have, and we do wish him a lot of luck. We are now attempting to get hold of our next guest, who's Linda Gibbons. And if you saw the National Post yesterday, and I'll hold it up right now, you've just, as evidence, as proof here, freed, but for how long? Her picture is there behind bars. Anti-abortion activist Linda Gibbons vows to defy law to defend beliefs. And, of course, that's what keeps getting Linda Gibbons behind bars, is that she says, you know what, as long as abortion is taking place, I'm going to protest. And if you're going to throw me in jail for protesting, shame on you. But she's willing to spend that time protesting. And, of course, another woman who's done that, a British Columbia woman named Mary Wagner, who spent a lot of time in behind bars as well, who Mike Hayden just referenced as well. So we are now joined from Ontario as well, anti-abortion activist and front page of the National Post cover girl, Linda Gibbons. Welcome to Roadkill Radio, Linda.
Good evening.
Good evening. It's Terry O'Neill here, and we're with Mark Hashuk, a co-host for the evening as well.
Hi, Linda.
Hello.
So after all of these years, Linda, all of the time that you've spent in and out of jail protesting, you finally end up on the front page of a national newspaper in essentially a positive article. How did this come about, and what was your what's your response today to all that?
Well, the National Post has been very good at following this story because I think they're very cognizant that it's about free speech. It's the abortion issue is something that deeply concerns me. But also the free speech issue is of concern to any of the media.
Well, that's absolutely right. They on paper say that they are concerned about free speech issues, but when push comes to shove, you know, if it's not an issue that they happen to like, they're not going to really go to bat for you. I know that some of the liberal papers aren't as excited about this case as the National Post because it's more sympathetic and open to discussion about the issue of abortion. So, you would think that in issues of free speech that and freedom of assembly that they would be, all newspapers, all television networks would be on top of this case. If it were somebody who is repeatedly being sent to jail for protecting trees, and I'm thinking in British Columbia of one particular woman, an elderly lady, grandmother. What's her name? Do you remember her name?
You're stumping me on that
sure,
one.
Sure, but yeah,
okay.
I've heard of her.
Yeah, then she gets on the front page all the time. Wayne, do you remember this woman's name? There's a grandma who keeps going to jail here in British Columbia for protecting the environment. Anyway.
Well, I saw a little picture I really liked. It showed a picture of about a five-month fetus, and it says, "Pretend I'm a tree and save me."
Yeah, well, that's exactly it, isn't it? So what's your status right now? The headline was freed, but for how long? What's your legal situation right now, Linda?
Well, we originally won a case back in 2008, and the Crown appealed it. And then we appealed their appeal, and now we're appealing to the Supreme Court. But the injunction will not be heard until the Supreme Court case in December 13th, and that is to decide how they're using these injunctions.
You are protesting inside of a zone that a judicial injunction has been issued about preventing protest. It's actually not legislation. Here in British Columbia, there is a provincial law, the bubble zone law, which stipulates where you can and can't protest. But in Ontario, where you've been protesting, there's actually no provincial law. It's an injunction that keeps on going and going and going.
Well, it's a temporary injunction.
Temporary injunction.
Never been taken to trial yet, even. I mean, to never been taken and handled, and it somehow has been left stalemated. And the Crown has decided to just sort of turn a blind eye to moving it forward or doing it, so it's sort of on ice.
Well, so there is an appeal at some stage. Where's your next court date?
Well, we're going to the Supreme Court in December.
Is that the Supreme Court of Canada?
Yes, and they will decide how the courts handle injunction breaches, because there's a discrepancy from province to province on how, what they're supposed to do when an injunction breach. And my lawyer's position is that when the injunction is breached, it should go back to the judge who issued it for him to decide. Instead, the Crown has said, well, we're going to go summarily. We're going through the criminal court. And for, I would say, 15 years, they would arrest me for the court order, which is indictable, high court. And then when it got to court, they would say, well, we're proceeding with obstruct. And that's the case I won, where a judge said, she's not obstructing. If she's broken the court order, you charge her with that. But there's no obstruct. The police have the authority under the injunction to, when the sheriff comes, because the sheriff must be there for a high court, and then you arrest her. So, but they were using obstruct under the criminal court as sort of a detour so that the injunction would not be able to be challenged directly.
Okay, so this was an obstruct under the criminal code. So in the National Post reported that you've been arrested 20 times for various offenses under the mm-hmm. criminal code. That's mm-hmm. their way of getting around having to deal with the messy implications of enforcing the injunction.
Mm-hmm.
No, brother.
But when a court permits and promotes and protects commercialized killing, it's not the function. It's a failure of government to protect life. It's a failure of the courts to prosecute those that are destroying life.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the function.
Absolutely.
I'm
sorry to cut you off, Linda. This is Mara Kashuk. This is yours is an incredible story, and any Canadian interested in fundamental rights should pay very close attention. I want you to tell us what the last 16 years has been like, how it's affected your life socially, financially. Could you just give us a sense of what you've been through since 1994?
Mm-hmm. Well, way back in the beginning, I was sort of trying to keep a job. I was working for the military headquarters. I had a pretty stable job, I would say. And then when you start to be arrested, all of a sudden you can't work as a civil servant anymore. So then you're sort of taking spells at trying to find work in between arrests. And then I came to the position that if I'm really going to challenge this injunction continuously, then steady work is something that is it's not conducive to the mission I'm on. But the more I got into it, I began to realize that you need to take the risk, you need to make the sacrifices, and just continue and say principle is principle. And when the actions of the court violate principle, then our actions will be according to principle.
So how did you spend your time in prison? I read somewhere that you often counseled fellow inmates.
Yeah, well, you sort of wear different hats. In one respect, you're trying to meet the women's social needs in the sense of they need to be out, they need to be off of the drugs or out of the street life, they need to get back on education, work, so that type of steering them in the right direction.
So you just didn't hit the weights when you were in prison. You were helping people.
Yeah, but then there's the spiritual needs, too, that these women are hurt and hurting. And, yeah, then there's the pro-life issue where you're counseling them not to have abortions because
sure.
the system expedites that as well. They're involved in the abortion industry.
Linda, who is supporting your case? Have pro-life groups stepped up and helped you with legal representation?
Well, for about 15 years, I really went without a lawyer, and I went silent in court, and I still do remain. In 20 years, I've never said a word in court. I don't, because if I would say my defense is I'm defending an unborn life, they would say the Supreme Court has said a baby has no rights and is not a person until 9 months and breathing and born. So, that position has left me really with no court costs legally because I didn't have a lawyer.
Right.
Then in 2008, I did take on Daniel Santoro, who you're familiar with,
mm-hmm.
and we are, as I say, making Supreme Court challenges. We're really somehow, instead of being defensive, we're trying to be a little offensive and challenge them. But then I'm using legal aid, which I never did before. But I qualify for it because I'm unemployed, no income, no assets. So, yeah.
Linda, do you plan to stay away from the protest zones between now and when your appeal will be heard, or are you going to get right
back? No, I would never. For me to do that would be to tell the unborn that that I need to toy with my commitment to them in order to play politics. And, yeah, I see the unborn as real people in real time with a responsibility and onus on us to defend them now and here and now. So, no, I don't intend to stay away.
Well, we have no doubt that you're in for the long haul. You've been in this for 16 years. Terry mentioned the front cover of the National Post. Since this really is some high-level media attention this case has gotten in the last couple of days, what's the reaction been to you personally? Are you receiving phone calls, emails of support? What's going on there?
I am. I have, I think there's a few local radio stations. I'm doing an interview Thursday morning locally here, and a newspaper I was involved with is writing another article. The Catholic Register is in process of doing an article, but I think they are saying this is an opportunity to expose not just what's happening to the unborn, which is a crime,
right?
But it's exposing all those that protect it and keep it. And the famous quote that I really like that to me hits it is Solzhenitsyn. Mm. He has said, when you take something that's wrong in society and bury it so deep that it doesn't even show on the surface, it will rise 1,000 times over. And I think we're beginning to see that ignoring we are making ourselves, we're doing demographic suicide, and it's morally hardening the hearts of the next generation.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that, but you don't even have to be pro-life to understand that this is wrong. You've spent more time in prison than many first-degree murderers in this country.
Well, a lot of girls who do a lot of time in jail, well, their standard action is, this is just wrong. So they know that when, even in jail, the inmates compare one case with someone else's case, sort of they have sort of a sliding rule of what's to be expected for what crime, and what's happening to me really boggles their mind.
Linda, you're obviously a very committed person to the pro-life cause. We talked just before you came on the air, we were talking to Mike Hayden, who's leading a group of young people walking across Canada to draw attention to the issue and to sort of witness for the pro-life cause. The sort of your sacrifice, your level of commitment to this, is this what you think more people need to do? Do you think every more pro-lifers should commit themselves to this to this level of protest that you've engaged in, or do you see that there's that you're a unique individual that can do this, and maybe everybody else really can't, and they can do other things?
Well, I really think when we take action and do something, and people will say, well, that looks a little radical or whatever. I think when you look at this situation, someone could well say, do you people really believe it's murder? If a child was being murdered in a house next door, would you sit down and write a letter to a politician? Would you make a phone call? We do need to become more proactive. And if we believe abortion is murder, then we need to act like it is.
Linda, is there one organization that you're associated with that people can send emails to or look on a website to get more information about your case or about how to support you?
You have LifeSite.
Yes.
And news, and they are excellent. And they are right. They've got the heartbeat of pro-life. They just follow it. Anyone following it would not be left out of the loop on any activity going on pro-life, Canada-wide or international-wide.
Okay, so that's lifesitenews.com, and that's a website that I check every day as well. And over the years, it has grown into being a very comprehensive site for all the life issues, plus family-related issues and legal issues as well. Good point there. But if anybody wanted to support you with a monetary donation or send you a, is there any group that they can go through to reach you, or you just
If they went through LifeSite, LifeSite would refer them to someone.
Good. Well, good luck in your coming legal battles and your sidewalk protests, and if you end up in jail again, Godspeed there as well, Linda Gibbons. You're a courageous individual, and it's a case that I'm glad more Canadians are learning about, and it's been our privilege to talk to you tonight.
Thank you so much for your time, and a blessing on your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. God bless you, Linda.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That, of course, was Linda Gibbons, and if you go to lifesitenews.com right now, you see that the main story actually is about Linda Gibbons. There's a picture there, exclusive interview.
What an amazing story.
It really is, and the level of commitment is awesome. And, I'm involved in the pro-life movement, and I have been on and off for a long time, and I feel very pipsqueaky next to somebody like this. I try to do what I do, and I think, boy, should I be doing more? These guys are walking across, Mike Hayden and his group walking across Canada. Linda standing up in such a strong way. It's pretty amazing, and it's very inspiring, and at the very least, we give her more publicity. It's good. There is a pro-life forum coming up in Toronto, by the way, for those listeners out there in Ontario. We've had a couple of Ontario guests. Actually, our last three guests have all have Ontario hometowns at the Saturday, June 25th, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. Toronto Pro-Life Forum. And there's news about that, a banner ad at lifesitenews.com as well.